and bright white, and she had opened her eyes and been still paralyzed, at least on one side, and still deeply stirred, although the feeling evaporated so quickly in the glare of the hospital lights and the sudden attention of the nurses and Meredith's guttural weeping, that she could convince herself that it had been something else, some medical condition. There had been no private room available, and she had had to share a room with a woman from north of Mount Mason who had had her gallbladder removed. She goes on and on about her grandchildren until you want to scream, Mrs. Blessing had said, slurring her words slightly since the stroke had been a minor one. She had not noticed the look on Meredith's face. After so many years of living alone, she had to remind herself that part of saying the right thing was reading the face of the person to whom you were speaking. It was no wonder that her own mother, who had tended to look down at her own rings whenever she talked, had so often gotten things wrong. "Come visit next weekend," Mrs. Blessing said into the phone suddenly, as the breathing on the baby monitor beside her rose and fell. She was certain, as she said the words, that she meant them as she never had before, and as certain that she would regret the offer once it was made. There was only so much change in her routine that she could manage at any given time. She looked down at the monitor again. "What's wrong?" Meredith said. "Nothing's wrong. Need something be wrong for me to invite you to come to the house? Never mind, never mind. Don't put yourself out." "Mother, we'd love to come, but there's a customer coming to look at that foal that was born last month. And an assessor." "What about the end of the month?"
"Well, I don't know,"
Mrs. Blessing said, as though she were studying her calendar. It always lay open on her desk, white, white, like the dress in her dream, the dress that covered her face like a cloud when Frank had thrown up the skirt. White except for here and there an appointment with the doctor, a note about a dinner. There was Jess's birthday marked on July 18th. Jess's birthday, but just now 16 years dead.
"I suppose that will have to do," she said to Meredith.
"I could try to reschedule the assessor."
"No, no, the end of the month is fine. I suppose Nadine can get some decent corn by then."
Through the window she could see the lawns spread gray-green around the pond, the grass dry from lack of rain. Some small black birds picked at the foot of the dock, and at the grass around the boat. For some reason, that curve of bright white wood on the lawn gave her the sort of quiet feeling of contentment that she now found rather rare, and she realized that cupping the baby's head for that brief moment had done the same. Those moments had always come rarely to her, and almost always about small creature comforts, never in times of great emotion. It was a feeling of peace, accompanied by a kind of settling in her chest that was usually taut and thrown forward so that when young her breasts had been emphasized in a way men found suggestive and yielding, and was really just the opposite. As a child, a pair of new shoes might bring the feeling on, and later a nice restaurant meal, or the simple sight of a quartet of iced martini glasses atop a tray out on the patio. The sight of Sonny had given her that feeling, too, when he came home from prep school or out to the house in the country, those years he had visited her here. And when she was much younger, she had had that feeling when her father entered the room. Everyone had expected her to have it with Meredith. Such a beautiful baby, such a lovely child, such green eyes, tip-tilted like the accents in her French text at Bertram's. Accent aigu, accent grave. Of course her hair had been red, like a flame atop the long pale candle of her face, red as Ethel Blessing had probably feared it would be when she sent Lydia away to the country, red as Frank Askew's had been when he was a boy, although when Lydia had first met him, his hair was faded to a rust color. Benny's mother had dredged up an aunt who had had auburn hair whenever anyone thoughtlessly mentioned it. Now that it no longer mattered, Meredith's hair was as silver as her own. Sometimes when she was young, Meredith had taken the boat out to the middle of the pond and sat with a book, an old straw hat of her grandfather's pulled low on her head. She had a lovely widow's peak, Meredith, clear and deep.
She never wore hats now except for the black riding helmet, always wore her silver hair pulled straight back, so that the widow's peak stood out on her forehead like an arrowhead. "Lids, my love," Edwin Blessing used to say, speaking in comfortably unoriginal aphorisms. "A gentleman wears a hat, or he stays inside." "You girls will wrinkle dreadfully in this sun," her mother had said on those rare occasions, after Meredith was born, when she'd come to Blessing's and watched Lydia and her friends dive off the dock. Mrs. Blessing had told Nadine that her little girl could use the boat, too. The boat that sat there day after day upturned, abandoned, unused. But Nadine would not allow it. "No, no," she had grumbled, "not right." Mrs. Blessing had been surprised to like Nadine's child. Like so much else in the world in which she found herself marooned, she had disapproved of the girl in theory. Men like Craig Foster should marry women from Mount Mason who went to the same church and knew the same people, not Korean women they had met somehow when they were soldiers stationed overseas. Nadine could not even be considered a war bride. Craig had been in Korea long after there had been an American war there. But his foreign wife and his foreign daughter had come to seem to Mount Mason more foreign still because some immigration regulations meant they had not been able to join the husband and father until 3 years after Craig Foster had come home. Legends had grown up about them during that time, like the legends about the man who lived on the dead end by the high school and never left his house. Mrs. Blessing had met Jennifer for the first time 12 years ago, when the child was six, when Nadine had been working for her for 6 months, and the little girl had had to stay home from school with an ear infection. She had perched on a stool in the corner of the kitchen all day long, so quiet that Mrs. Blessing knew she was there only because from time to time she heard on the air, like a treble counterpoint to the atonal music of Nadine's flat, fractured English, a high lilt.
"I am very pleased to meet you, ma'am, and I am sorry that I have had to come with my mother today," the child had said when Mrs. Blessing came into the kitchen, under the pretense of asking for a change in the lunch menu.
She had been tickled by the stiff little speech of a sentence, and the oddly outdated clothes the girl wore, what Mrs. Blessing still thought of as appropriate clothes, a plaid skirt, a wool sweater, knee socks, laced shoes. She had not recognized the clothes as Meredith's cast-offs, 4 decades old, preserved between tissue, silted with mothballs. Mrs. Blessing had asked Nadine to give the clothes to the Salvation Army when a new roof had had to be put on and the attic cleaned out as a result. "There's obviously no point in keeping them for Meredith," said Mrs. Blessing, who in some inchoate way disapproved of her daughter's childlessness. Nadine had picked out the hand-stitched monograms with a pair of scissors, ironed and ironed until the peaks and valleys where the stitches had lain were pressed out, and kept the clothes herself. Meredith was talking about one of their horses, a pulled muscle, she said, visits from the vet. Mrs. Blessing was not listening. Now, at age 80, the past so distant and yet so perfectly clear, like one of the dioramas in the Natural History Museum, her mind tended to drift. From the monitor, she heard a series of thuds, and her heart beat fast until she realized it was the sound of footsteps going up the stairs of the apartment. It irritated her that she had been so addled by sleep and the heat and the surprise of the phone and what her father had called wool gathering that she had not heard the truck return. Or perhaps he'd used the back drive, which came from the road around the barn. That was a sneaky sort of thing to do. On the monitor, she heard the footsteps louder now, and a few notes of the mobile's music box again. "What's that?" Meredith said. "Nothing," Lydia said. "I believe Nadine's listening to the radio. She's there late today." What was Meredith saying? That she had hired a new housekeeper herself because the one she'd had not suited. "The apple doesn't fall far from the tree," Lydia could hear her father saying. She was growing tired of all these people speaking at once, the past, the present, perhaps even the future in the slow breathing of the baby. From the monitor, she heard a voice whispering, "Hey, sweet pea. Hey, Faith, I'm home, I'm home." Softly, Skip began to sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. He didn't know all the words, and his voice was almost tuneless.
For some reason she simply could not fathom, Lydia felt tears fill her eyes.
"I hope I haven't made a mistake,"
she said, interrupting Meredith, who was talking about a stallion in Middleburg who was available for stud.
"Pardon?" Meredith said. "About this new man," said Lydia.
"Oh, Mother, you're never satisfied."
"I'm perfectly satisfied when things are done correctly."
"And does he do things correctly?"
"I suppose he does," Lydia said.
The thing that amazed him, when he listened to her old-fashioned locutions, the shalls instead of wills, when he looked at her living room, that would have been faintly shabby and purely ridiculous if it had been in one of those big development houses down the hill, was that you couldn't get loose from what you were born into. Everyone believed you could, in America, but it wasn't true. One moment you were a Boatwright baby with a crusty nose and a diaper that should have been changed 2 game shows ago, and then you were a Boatwright girl giving hand jobs in pickup trucks and carting around a baby of your own. You weren't ever a cheerleader or a college girl or one of the women who sat behind a desk at the First National Bank and said, "Can I help you?" And your mortgage approval should take approximately 10 to 14 working days. Just like if you were Robert Benteman and you ran your Corolla into a tree and got popped with hash in your pocket. Instead of going to jail like Skipper Joe would, you wound up in rehab in Arizona, then at Arizona State, which would lead to law school, which is what your lawyer dad planned in the first place. Robert Benteman was a moron and once burned a girl with a cigarette just for the hell of it. But thin blonde girls with sweaters tied around their shoulders, who would freeze Skip if he smiled at them, sat at their desks in high school and wrote Mrs. Robert Benteman on the covers of their spiral notebooks. Maybe, he thought, in the truck on his way to the Mount Mason Medical Center, that was why he wanted to keep Faith, and why he thought he should give her up, too. Her parents were going to make the difference between that sweater tied around her shoulders and some flimsy maternity t-shirt with an arrow pointing down at her belly at age 16. Maybe if he gave her to some nice cookies and milk woman and suit and tie man, she'd wind up sleeping in a canopy bed in one of those mock tutor houses that clean people with new money seem to like so much. Or maybe he could just make something of himself, and so make something of her. He wasn't sure how to do that. "Not college material," the counselor had said in high school, looking at his shop courses and his address. But Craig Foster had managed to edge into the middle of Mount Mason society with his auto body shop, managed to mingle at the Elks Club with the plumbing contractors and the restaurant owners. Maybe Skip could do something like that. Try working his way up in some business in which he could work with his hands. He'd become one of those people who could take his daughter on vacations, not to Europe the way the lawyers and doctors did, but at least to Florida somewhere. He could just imagine showing up at his father's new place, in a polo shirt and pressed slacks, handing his old man a business card. Cuddy Sheetrocking, or Cuddy Painting Contractors. He'd show off his little girl, talk about their new ranch house a couple of miles out of town. Wall-to-wall carpeting all through the house and a spa on the patio, he'd say. He'd always had a little bit of contempt for those kinds of guys, all clean clothes and briefcases and high blood pressure, ruddy and smelling of lemon aftershave. But he'd join their ranks if it would buy a sleepover for Faith in one of their daughter's pink gingham rooms. At least she had a cradle now, a carved cherry cradle on shallow rockers that Mrs. Blessing had told him to come and take from a musty back bedroom in the big house. He had tickled himself with the thought of tying a string to his toe and looping its other end around the ornamental curves at the head of the little bed so that in the nighttime he could rock her without getting up. But she was such a good baby now, so orderly and cooperative in her habits, that the idea was more of a cartoon construct than anything he needed to consider. He felt stupid sometimes. How he liked to watch her. How he still flinched when she popped herself in the nose with her spastic fist. How her face went real still, and her mouth opened as she watched the sunlight shoot down onto the floor next to her blanket. How she would smile like a spasm, and it would go straight to his heart. He'd watched some doctor on his little TV and seen him make babies, little babies just as small as Faith was, imitate the things he did. And though they were stupid things, Skip did them every day, pushing out his tongue slowly, watching her do the same over and over. He figured when she was 6 months old, he would start to read books to her. And when she started to stand, he would get her shoes. Shoes were a problem, too, though, like sleeping positions. Some books said that they provided support for the feet, others that they were unnecessary and maybe uncomfortable. He'd have to think about that one a little more. When she went down at 9, woke at 2, slept until 7, sucked down a bottle, and went down again for 2 hours more, he could convince himself that the future might be that regular. First grade, junior high, a life with a place for everything and everything in its place. When she stayed up half the night and threw up all down the back of his only remaining clean T-shirt, he didn't know if he was going to make it, and he figured it must somehow be his fault. He'd always been a pretty tidy guy for a guy, but the apartment had clothes and towels and cans and bottles all over the tables and counters. And just when he thought he was getting it cleaned up, a diaper would explode out the sides and onto the legs of one of those little suits with the snaps that he'd bought. And there'd be dirty sheets and shirts tied up in a case by the kitchen window to isolate the odor. "Charles," Mrs. Blessing had called one evening, "where are you taking those things?" "I've got to go to the laundromat," he said. "The monitor is on and she's asleep." "Nonsense," Mrs. Blessing said with a frown. "There's a perfectly good washing machine in the basement. Just use the basement door." He tried to look into Faith's eyes at times when all the things she needed seemed too much for one man. To fasten on her face, and not just the endless tasks she seemed to generate. "Teaching you to ride a two-wheeler is going to be so cool," he said once. He thought about when he had learned. He had been 9 years old, and his friends found out he didn't know how to ride a bike. Chris had taught him to ride. Chris had run beside him, his arm shaking with the weight of the bike, and Skip on it. It hadn't been easy to teach him, but Chris had kept at it all one weekend, and by Sunday afternoon he'd finally learned. "I learned to ride a bike," he said that night to his father, who was watching football on TV. "That's good." It didn't seem to occur to his dad that he was about 4 years late on the learning. But the next weekend, his father brought home a pretty nice secondhand bike he'd gotten from a guy who sold things out of his garage. "You know, I never did learn to ride one of these things myself," his father said, watching Skip make jerky circles in the driveway. "I'll teach you to swim in the pond," Skip said to Faith, "and to fish." She hooted in reply, arched her back, shuddered, then hooted again. "Talk to your baby whenever the spirit moves you," the book said. "He understands more than you can imagine." "Faith," he said each night when he put her to bed, "you're safe." Sometimes he really believed this was true. He did a lot of the outside jobs at Blessings in the evenings now, after Nadine was gone, and he could take the baby with him while he vacuumed the pool, filled the bird feeders, cleaned the boathouse. She would lie on a blanket, twisting her head from side to side, watching the play of light on the surface of a window, the pond, the slowly darkening edge of the western sky. Sometimes Mrs. Blessing would sit in one of the white wooden rockers on the front porch, and he would leave Faith on a blanket on the lawn just past the walk, lying among the small umbrellas of Pachysandra. "This child is going to roll over sooner than you think," Mrs. Blessing said once, and, "those nails are badly in need of a cutting," and, "she has especially long fingers." But mostly she rocked and watched and looked sideways over the pond while he worked. He looked at the old woman and the big house and the spreading pachysandra and the roses growing along the terrace, and he thought that maybe it would all work out, that the little girl could grow up here. When the breeze was soft and the fish flipped in the air over the pond and dove back down into the green water again, and Mrs. Blessing's tight, disapproving mouth relaxed into something like a smile, he could convince himself that somehow no one would notice that
Instead of a mother and a father and a birth certificate, this particular child had this young guy and this old woman in a cardboard box and a barrette that had once clamped her cord. As Mrs. Blessing said, who cared about one baby? Faith, you have a good deal, he'd whispered on one of those nights. But that night when he heard Joe outside his window calling, yo, dude, dude, he knew that any little girl of his in this town would have a hard road to hoe, even if he found a way to explain her to people. Yo, Joe yelled, yo. And Skip went downstairs because he couldn't let Joe come up with Faith slumped in the baby swing, listening to its tinny workings picking out the Sesame Street theme song while she tried to get her thumb into her mouth. Joe smelled like turpentine and tobacco. You painting again? Skip said.
Yo, man, you need a phone for emergencies.
What's the emergency? A light went on in the back of the big house in what Skip thought was Mrs. Blessing's bathroom. She'd managed to come around about the baby, but he didn't think Joe was the sort she'd want visiting the place. For that matter, Skip didn't want him there either.
Come in the garage, he whispered.
What's up?
You got a beer upstairs?
You drove all the way out here to get a beer?
What kind of way is that to talk, man? You think I'm a moron? I drive all the way over here for a beer?
Skip sighed. Talking to Joe was like driving a tractor through mud. He remembered when he was living in the trailer, how Joe had a big sign on one side of the steps that said, Beware of dog. He remembered pointing at it saying, you want someone to be where? What's that? Where? He'd laughed. It's not two words, man, he'd said, but Joe's eyes had stayed blank, not getting the joke. I don't get ya, Joe had said.
Joe, just tell me what's up, Skip said softly in the big bay of the garage, his words echoing faintly. What's going on? You need help with something?
No, man, it's Chris, all right? Chris busted up his motorcycle bad. I tried to call you this morning, but I forgot your old number didn't work anymore, and I woke up your aunt. She was pissed, man. She said to tell you to get your stuff out of her garage. She's still really mean, you know, like she hasn't mellowed at all.
Skip grabbed Joe's arm to get him back on track. Is Chris okay?
It looked really bad, man. He almost coded on the table. Joe watched a lot of hospital emergency room shows. He'd wanted to be an EMT, but he'd had a felony conviction for a B&E when he was 18, and that took care of running the cherry lights on an ambulance. Another reason why Skip hadn't given him up on the quick stop deal.
But he's gonna make it.
Joe shrugged.
Maybe permanent damage in one leg, man. He broke a lot of shit, a lot of shit. But the thing is, he really wants to see you. I think he saw the white light last night.
Joe watched a lot of shows about miracles and mysteries, too. He was always peering at people in the mall to see if they looked like anyone on America's Most Wanted.
He really needs to make things right with you.
Things are right with me, Skip said. Things are right with me, he thought. I never see Chris anymore. That's exactly right.
Dude, Joe gripped his arm. Go see him. Go tomorrow.
He went. He put the baby to bed early, at 8, which gave him an hour to drive over before visiting hours ended at 9. Mrs. Blessing turned on the baby monitor and placed it by the chair in the library, and Skip left a bottle in the kitchen refrigerator just in case. He'd wound the mobile before he came downstairs, but the tune was starting to slow already. She won't wake up, he said as Mrs. Blessing cocked her head. I'll be back soon. Not much time to visit, which was fine with him. There was a picture of Mrs. Blessing's father in the lobby of the hospital. He looked like an actor in a period film, a high stiff collar, a mustache, and a level look from beneath a thatch of thick light hair. He was holding a shovel the way a man does who has never used one. Time flies, Mrs. Blessing had said he had carved on those benches out by the apple trees. When he'd given them $10,000 in 1925, the Mount Mason Infirmary had been in an old colonial house. Then it had become the Mount Mason Hospital in a collection of sullen brick buildings with two small windows, and now it was the Mount Mason Medical Center and looked like an airport for a smallish town. The lobby was called the Blessing Lobby, in the hope that a testamentary bequest would follow the compliment. Skip would bet money against that one. You just couldn't get away, no matter how hard you tried, he thought when he walked into Chris's room. There was Ed, and Ed's little brother Sam, and Joe and Debbie wearing her waitress uniform, going right from the hospital to McGuire's. Actually, they were probably all going straight from the hospital to McGuire's. There was Shelley, at least 20 pounds heavier, in stretch exercise shorts, and a big T-shirt that wasn't improving things one bit, holding a bald baby dressed in a diaper and a shirt that said Little Deer, with a picture of a fawn on it. And there was Chris's mom in a slippery white polyester tunic smelling of bleach and beer, sobbing into the shoulder of his shirt as she hurled herself at his chest.
Could have been killed. Stand to lose him. Happy you're here, my baby. My baby.
Skip patted her lightly on the back, the way he burped Faith.
What's up?
Chris whispered, squinting at him through blackened eyes. Skip was shamed by his first thought, that if Chris had taken it a step further and bought the farm, Spencer's funeral home would have had a tough time making him look presentable for his mother. He had two cuts on his face, closed with stitches, long train tracks along his forehead and one cheek. Both eyes had gone black, and he had big fish lips. His leg was in a cast. Skip felt weary looking at him.
This is why they passed helmet laws, man, he said.
Chris nodded and looked at him.
Everybody wait in the hall, he said. I got business with Skipper.
I have to leave soon, honey, Chris's mom said. I got late shift at the nursing home.
Go to work, Ma. I'll see you tomorrow. Bring me some glazed donuts, okay, and some decent coffee from that place on Main Street. The rest of you I'll see tomorrow, whatever.
Sit down, Skip.
Man, I haven't seen you in a couple weeks. Ed says you hired his old man to put a roof on the old lady's barn.
Skip could hear everybody talking out in the hall. Chris's mom was sobbing, saying something about glazed donuts. Skip nodded.
It's a strange roof, kind of like an upside-down boat or something.
He said you can't work it with a scaffold, only ladders.
I've seen it, Chris said. I had to deliver chicken wire up there one day before I got fired at the hardware store. That's some sweet piece of land.
So, Skip said.
So,
Chris said, his fingers drumming on the top sheet.
I got such a Jones for a cigarette, I'm going mental. Don't look at me. Yeah, well, next time. Here's the deal, dude. I figure this was a wake-up call. Like, I have to get my shit together. You're the only one who would get that. And part of the deal is, like they say in AA, to make things right with people you screwed up with.
You're going to AA?
Chris laughed. Man, I said a wake-up call, not a brain transplant. No, remember? I went out with that girl, Chris. She went to AA, or NA, or Al-Anon, whatever. She told me you're supposed to make it up with the people you screwed. The whole time I was in the ambulance. Oh, man, wait, I need to tell you, one of the ambulance guys was that kid, Shorty. Remember, that we stuffed in the urinal that one time after gym? He looks at me lying in the road, and I swear to God, he got a look on his face like, if I didn't have this other EMT here, I'd just let your ass bleed to death.
Yeah, well, we kind of made a mistake with him. He was 4 feet tall until he was 15. Then all of a sudden he was 6'3".
And he lifts, man. He's got upper arms on him like iron.
Chris lifted his own arm, then let it drop.
Oh, I'm going to be so out of shape when they let me out of here. I'm going to look like shit.
Skip tried to look at his watch without looking like he was looking. Chris saw him. He put out his hand. Skip could tell just by looking at what he'd done to himself that he'd put the bike into a skid and flipped onto his left side.
The cops run a blood alcohol on you? Skip asked.
Chris grabbed his hand tight and squeezed, and his eyes filled. He nodded and bit his lip.
The weirdest thing is, I was stone cold sober.
I got work bringing in hay at Jensen's farm, and because of the weather forecast, they made us start really early and work all day. We were still mowing when the sun went down. Then Mrs. Jensen, she brings out this big picnic thing, like chicken and potato salad and big jugs of lemonade. They're Mormons or Moravians or something, I can't remember, but they don't drink. And some of the other guys are like, man, I want a beer. But she made biscuits, too, and cake, and I figured I'd go to McGuire's later because all I could think was that I hadn't had a dinner like that in I don't know how long. Ed's mom used to make us pretty good dinners when we were kids, remember? But they won't even let me in the house now, his parents. And Joe's mom is like my mom, you know. She thinks it's a big deal if she puts a frozen pizza in the microwave. I must have stayed there until 10, sitting in the field, feeding the chicken to the cats, just chilling, you know, looking at the stars and shit. I just hit the curve too fast on the way home. And then there was a raccoon or something in the road, and the next thing I know, I hear this noise and feel this hard feeling, and I'm looking up at the sky, and I can taste my teeth. Isn't that weird? All I can remember at first is tasting my teeth, then seeing Shorty and thinking, oh, man, I am screwed. You're lucky to be alive, man. I know, that's the point. If I'd checked out, I'd have felt really bad about the way I left things with you. I would have felt bad that I didn't say, you know, I'm really sorry. It was really whack how that whole thing came down, how you took the weight for all of us. Skip shrugged. Yeah, I know you're still pissed, but I just want you to understand that I get that, and I screwed up, and I'm sorry. Yeah, okay, that's enough of that shit. What's up with you? You give Ed's old man work after how he's treated you. He shrugged again. He does good work, Skip said. I gotta go. Busy man, Chris said. So, are we cool? Sure, no problem. Jesus, I'd kill for a beer, man, Chris said. Get him a beer, Skip told Joe out in the hall. Shelley was looking at him, trying to pretend she wasn't, certain that he was going to yell at her in the hallway of the hospital, hoping he would so she could talk about it at McGuire's for the next month. A little drama in a boring life. Skip walked over and looked at the baby. It had whiteheads on its cheek and was sucking on a pacifier. Pacifier to cigarette to Budweiser, Skip thought and sighed. About 6 months, right? He said. Next week, she said. Yeah, well, you might want to lose the pacifier. Those things are really bad for the shape of their mouths, he murmured. Who asked your opinion? Shelley said. She smelled sour, or maybe it was the baby, or both of them. He could tell by the smudges beneath her eyes that she was still wearing last night's makeup. When he starts walking, you'll have to pin it to his shirt. Who the hell asked you? Shelley said. I'd throw it away now, Skip said. Come out with us, man, Ed said. Come, have a beer. I'm not going anywhere he's going, Shelley said. God, who the hell does he think he is? I'm going home, Skip said. I gotta go home. He had pulled the truck around so that the cab threw a thick divot of shade on the ground, and he had placed Faith there, face up, out of the late August sun. Her eyes seemed to follow the motion of the apple trees, as the twisted branches moved slightly in the occasional breeze. Once or twice, she smiled crookedly at nothing. How old did you say she is? Mrs. Blessing said, looking down, leaning as lightly as she was able, on the old, gnarled stick with a silver lion's head that had been her father's as she lowered herself into a canvas folding chair. That had been her father's, too. He bought it at Abercrombie's just before the war, just before all the canvas was set aside for the army. 10 weeks, give or take a couple days, said Skip. She should have gotten her shots. I don't know what to do about that. It says in the book that she should get her first shots at 6 weeks. I don't think I can afford to take her to a doctor. I may be able to manage that, Mrs. Blessing said. I know a doctor who will come here. But then he's very discreet. Doctors tended to be so in my day. There wasn't all this talking about things, cancer and so on. I don't know about these younger doctors. I saw one for my arthritis, and I didn't care for him a bit. Korean, I think he was, and spoke as though he had mush in his mouth. Like Nadine. I can understand Nadine perfectly well. This man couldn't say a consonant to save his soul. Dr. Benjamin will come out to examine her. He's a good, plain speaker. I want to see him first. The book says you should interview the baby's pediatrician to make sure you like him, or her. Beggars can't be choosers, she said tartly. I guess. Mrs. Blessing herself had never really read books about child rearing. There had been one that had been popular when Meredith was young that said spanking was a sin and would break the spirit, but Mrs. Blessing had thought that was nonsense. She had let Nanny paddle Meredith whenever she was badly behaved, just as she herself had been paddled. It had not happened often in either case. Only Sunny had been disciplined by a parent, her father by the barn with a belt. It had happened 3 times. I ruined my good linen shorts with blood, was all Sunny said the second time when he was 13. She had not been back to the orchard in so many years. The last time she could remember being there, Jess had persuaded her to pick fruit for pies. But the apples had been pocked, stunted, deformed somehow, and she and Jess had been younger women then, their hair stippled dark and gray instead of silver. It had never occurred to her that decades would pass before she would go again this far back into her own land. When she had first come out to Blessings to have her baby, her world had been confined to Mount Mason. Then slowly she had stopped going to town much, and her world had been confined to Blessings. Then increasingly to the house, and in the house to her room, the living room, the study, and the den. The dining room had the downcast look of rooms no one used anymore. That long expanse of polished cherry with the 12 waiting chairs made her feel lonely, though she preferred to think of herself as someone who merely lived alone. Skip placed Faith on Mrs. Blessing's lap, and she held the child tightly around the waist, encircling her with her arms. One fist closed reflexively over Mrs. Blessing's index finger, and just as reflexively she began to stroke the small hand with her thumb. The baby felt warm on the hot afternoon, but with a different sort of warmth, the warmth of life, the same warmth that slipped from the body when life was gone. Mrs. Blessing thought of Sunny and shuddered. Her head dropped and her lips touched the light down on the small round head, and one of the baby's hands came up and grabbed at her hair. "No, no, no, Faithy," Skip said. "It's all right, Charles. She's simply exploring." A jay flew by, and Mrs. Blessing felt the baby turn with its trajectory, her eyes on it until it was gone. The trees had aged as she had, slowly, inexorably, indubitably. She could remember them as they had been after Papa had first seen them come into flower, and then fruit, 60 of them planted over 5 acres beside the creek. The project had proceeded in fits and starts, as most of them had, because her mother would pay, then not pay. Then pay again. "I'll not have him spend my money, the son of a bitch. Not if he can't keep his hands to himself," her mother had muttered one evening years later in the nursing home when her dementia was far along. Edwin Blessing had put a bench at either end of the orchard so that he could come out and sit in the evenings. "I can hear the fruit ripen," he had said once. Carved in the high backs of the benches were the words, "Tempus fugit." "What do you think?" Skip said, looking around at the tree's misshapen limbs and broken branches. "I am not a botanist," Mrs. Blessing said. Nadine's eyes had burned with anger when he had come into the kitchen, said that he wanted not only to see Mrs. Blessing, but also to take her with him in the truck to look at the apple orchard, which he felt needed special attention, spraying, pruning, more than he could manage. "My truck can handle the back drive fine," he told her. "It goes right up into the middle of the trees. You won't even have to get out if you don't want to." "Almost lunch," Nadine had muttered. "Nonsense, Nadine. It's just past noon. I won't eat for an hour at least." "Too old," Nadine shouted suddenly. "I beg your pardon," Mrs. Blessing said stiffly. "Charles, go to the umbrella stand by the front door and bring me the walking stick. Nadine, I hope it has been polished recently." "Crazy," muttered Nadine, "crazy people." The worst moment had been climbing into the cab of the truck. She clutched the edge of the door, her foot raised. It was high, higher than she thought she could manage. She was almost defeated, not by her body, but by her mind and her memory, which could see herself, no, feel herself, leaping into the passenger seat with one swift, easy motion. She could feel the girl and the younger woman, and she wanted them suddenly, terribly, as she had not wanted them before. It was as though all the people she had once been were contained inside her failing flesh. The watchful child in buckled shoes, the young woman leaning back against unfamiliar pillows to open herself up to Frank Askew, the new mother amazed and terrified by the indelible product of those covert meetings, the older woman waiting for something unexpected to happen in a life set in stone so long ago. Sonny's sister, Jess's friend, Benny's wife. Perhaps it was the memory of all of them that helped her to place the hesitant foot firmly and pull herself, with a sound like a sigh, into place. Behind the seat was a long basket covered with a striped dishcloth, and when they had taken the road behind the garage, Skip reached back and pulled the cloth away so she could see Faith, blinking, big-eyed. "It seems to me that she has exceptionally long eyelashes," Mrs. Blessing said. Skip smiled. "That's what I was thinking. But maybe they stop growing, and by the time her face is adult size, they won't look so long. I keep thinking of all these things I don't know. It's weird that I wasted time learning algebra in high school, and yet they didn't teach us one thing about children. And there were plenty of girls in the class, too, and a lot of them have babies now, and they're just as ignorant as me. You said she ought to get out more, so I'm trying to get her out more. The book says she gets vitamin D from the sun. Now, see, they should have taught us that. No wonder so many kids in Mount Mason are all pale and sickly-looking, like they live under a rock. I really do want you to look at these trees, but I thought it might make a change, too, you know, to sit outside and just watch her play in the middle of the day." "She's too young to play, surely," Mrs. Blessing said, looking into the basket. "You'd be surprised how much fun she has just looking around. Right, Faith? Right, Faithy?" "That is a pretty name," Mrs. Blessing said. When she had come to Blessing's to wait for her own baby to arrive, she had found something called the Mother's Encyclopedia on the shelves near the back stairs. In the blue light of an early snowfall, she had sat by the fire in the library and tried to read it. Mrs. Foster brought her tea and toast on a tray. "I pray every day for your young man," she had said. The set of books with the red cloth covers and gilt letters on the spines had been as much a part of her girlhood as prams in the park and lavender sachet pillows in her underwear drawer. D for diaper rash, O for obedience and otitis media, ear infections. She had found only one section underlined in pencil after meningitis and money came a chapter on Mother's Job, and someone had drawn a heavy gray bracket around "Can love be compelled?" and underlined the sentences. "For the mother, poor girl, is frightened at herself for not wanting the baby. She feels that she is a criminal and no one else was ever like her. Perhaps she has even wished that it might die. And here it is now, rosy and sweet, kicking its heels and making funny, amiable noises at her." She was certain her mother had underlined the passage. She remembered the night she and Sonny had snuck out and slept in the boat. There was still a small gash in its prow to mark where they drifted hard into the far bank in the dark and been jarred awake by the impact and the willow branches trailing like fingers over both their faces. "She's so strict about everything," she had whispered to Sonny. "When I wanted to wear my amber beads to Lucy Warren's birthday luncheon, she told me the Warrens would think we were vulgar. The Warrens! Half the chairs in their house have the stuffing coming out." "You know why," Sonny had said.
"Why?"
Sonny had drifted with his hand in the water. He was sitting on the bottom of the boat, his head resting on one of the seats, and Lydia could remember that he was smiling to himself, as though he was pleased about what he was about to tell her.
"It's because she's Jewish."
"Who?"
"Mother. Her parents were Jews."
"Don't be silly.
She goes to St. Stephen's every Sunday with us. Nearly every Sunday she says Jerusalem is her favorite hymn.
Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Jerusalem.
It's all for show, Liddy, Sunny had said.
Before her name was Simpson, it was something else. That's why everything has to be just so. So it won't matter that she's Jewish, but it does.
How do you know?
I listen to things, he said. At the Cartons one day, Benny and I were eating in the kitchen, and these people were having drinks out in the sunroom, and one of the women said that Mother had married Father for position and Father had married Mother for money.
I thought Papa was the one who had the money.
That's what everyone is supposed to think. How wise Sonny had been. How much he could see that she could not. She thought that that was why he was so melancholy and so amused in equal measure. He had fallen asleep in the boat long before she had, one hand resting on her leg as though to make sure she would not go over the side. The air was pale blue-gray when they both heard the sounds of screaming from inside the house.
"What's wrong? Why are they doing that?"
she'd cried, her hair and her face pulled loose from its ribbon.
"Because of us, I think," Sunny said.
She must have been almost 11 because it was 6 months after the Lindbergh baby had been taken in 1932. Their nanny had found her bed empty, then Sonny's, had gotten hysterics, and then fallen to the kitchen floor. The Fosters had run across the drive, Mrs. Foster still in her nightgown with Mr. Foster's work jacket over it, held closed with one hand. Papa had rung the dinner bell. He had looked ridiculous. But Mama had not even come downstairs.
"They'll turn up," she'd said. "What a fuss."
After that day, Lydia Blessing could never see her mother in the same way again. And she was never sure whether it was because Ethel Blessing had stayed in bed, waiting for coffee, when everyone else was panicked at the thought that they were gone, or because she was Jewish. When her mother had hired the Cartons decorator to make their new house look more or less exactly like the Cartons, when she had forbidden Lydia to wear red to parties or to lighten her hair with lemon, when she had sent her to Blessing's and made it impossible for her to come back to New York again, Lydia had always wondered whether an Episcopalian mother would have behaved differently. Perhaps she would have acted just the same. After all, what was Ethel Blessing doing but a careful imitation of an Episcopalian mother? How her two children had foiled her in what was to be the crowning gesture of her difficult passage into social Protestantism. Two good marriages. That was all it would have taken to launder Ethel Blessing's origins forever. Instead, there was Sunny living in a top-floor apartment in a house in Greenwich Village, writing jingles, smoking small black cigars. Instead, there was Lydia, living in Purda amid the possums and the lumbering black bear, living in Purda with a red-headed child with a widow's peak like a brand on her broad white brow. How she had clung, Ethel Blessing, to that carton in Meredith's name, to the polite fiction politely accepted, of the love match, the soldier, the bereavement, the early labor, the country air. "You are a careless girl," she had said to Lydia on many occasions. "You take for granted your advantages. You don't know the value of a dollar. The world doesn't owe you a living." The old truisms had the rote sound of repetition, almost like mimicry, and it occurred to Lydia long after her mother was dead that perhaps they had first been said to the young Ethel Simpson, or Seats, or Simpkiss, or whatever her name had been, by her own father, whose fortune made from bolts of brocade had allowed his only child to deny her past. She leaned closer to look at the baby lying on a blanket on the grass. They knew nothing about her, whether her mother was young or old, rich or poor, but Mrs. Blessing could see that this baby was beloved. And in the soft grass, with the breeze blowing the crippled limbs of the old apple trees, that seemed to be all that mattered. Skip knelt before Faith and cleaned and changed her, then cradled her in his arms. He still had a bit of that tentative godfather at the font quality that men kept, although Mrs. Blessing had heard that so many more of them took care of their children now. She had to admit that she was surprised by the name he had chosen. She had been a bit put out when she was not consulted, but what he had decided on was in impeccable taste. She would not have objected to a grandchild by that name. The baby was holding her head up now, her eyes enormous, ranging around the trees and sky and over both their faces like a searchlight.
She made small bird noises of pleasure, then spread her arms wide, bounced slightly in Skip's arms as though she were ready to fly, then seemed to think better of it and clung to his shoulder with her starfish hands. She was an eager, playful little thing, with a constant light in her eyes. Mrs. Blessing was certain that not all babies were that way. Even Jess had had one, Henry, who had been dull and disconsolate. "Do you ever give any thought to the woman who must have left her here?" she said. "All the time. I try not to, but I wonder about her all the time. She is her mother, after all." "No. See, that's where I think you're wrong. Because I keep thinking that that's not how you get to be the mother. You get to be the mother like this. You get to be the mother by changing her and giving her a bath and walking her around in the middle of the night and loving her and making her feel like everything's all right. That's how you get to be the mother. That's what being the mother is. That means I'm the mother, more or less." "Well, then, have you considered that she may be better off with a man and a woman who want to adopt a child, who have a proper home and so forth?" "She's mine," he said. "You can feel it, can't you? She's mine." Faith reared back and looked into Skip's eyes and crowed and reached for his face. "Do you want to hold her again?" "In a minute," Mrs. Blessing said. "She looks quite pleased with herself at the moment." "Oh, she is," Skip said, talking to the baby, rubbing her nose with his own. "She is pleased with herself. I am pleased with herself. We are pleased with each other, and that's the deal. That's the deal. That's the deal." "People talk such nonsense to babies," Mrs. Blessing said. "I wonder why." "Maybe we all ought to talk more nonsense more of the time." He lifted Faith over his head and swooped her back and forth, up and down, and she sucked in her breath. Mrs. Blessing looked over the rows of twisted gray tree trunks. She and Sonny had eaten apples from these self-same trees, Rome apples so full of juice that it ran down their chins and onto the Irish sweaters Nanny made them wear in autumn. "If you have these trees properly cared for, will they bear fruit again?" she asked. "I'm pretty sure." "How much will it cost?" "A couple of thousand. It won't be cheap." "And you found someone capable?" He slung Faith over his shoulder. She lifted her domed head sharply, once, twice, three times, then let it fall to one side and sucked her fist. "Barton's nursery. He says his grandfather put these trees in the first place. He says his grandfather used to tell a story about how your father memorized the leaves and the bark and the flowers so that he could walk from tree to tree and know whether it was winesap or yellow delicious or Rome. He made us do the same," Mrs. Blessing said. "He said the trees would be here bearing fruit when he was only a memory in the minds of those who loved him. That's why he had Tempus Fugit carved into these benches. Time flies." My father had a very extravagant turn of phrase and mind. He was right, though. Mrs. Blessing shook her head. "Since you've come to work for me, I have managed to do a great many things I never expected to do." The baby made a grunting noise, then a funny whistle, then a grunt again. "Will you harvest the fruit?" she said. "Yes, ma'am. Will you get her a doctor?" "I will. But I think you must focus on the future, Charles, and how you will manage in the years to come. There must be something that can be done. Perhaps I will consult my attorney." "Maybe," he said. "Maybe. Let me think about it. It's still early, isn't it? I mean, she can't even sit up yet." One afternoon, when the air was hot and thick as soup, Skip heard music coming from the front of the house. He was driving back from the orchard, driving through dirty clouds of gnats with the long-handled pruning clippers and the porta-crib bouncing in the back of the pickup truck. Just after sunrise, he had driven almost 20 miles to a 24-hour price club in Bessemer to get diapers and formula. Women smiled at him in the bright white light of the aisles because he was wearing the baby in a front pack on his chest. It reminded him of the picture of the Sacred Heart of Jesus that Chris's mom had on the wall of her bedroom, his chest a glowing symbol of his absolute goodness. He imagined that all the women had dirtbag husbands who went out to the bar when the kid had a fever, or boyfriends who dropped a 10 on the kitchen table for diapers. Last week in the paper, there had been a story he almost skipped right over about single fathers, and then he realized that he was a single father. Holding a job, the story said, arranging playdates. He was nodding his head. The playdates part was pushing it, but he tried to imagine Faith going over to someone's house to build with blocks and sit in the inflatable pool. He didn't want her playing with Shelley's grubby son, or the kids that his other old friends might have, coming home covered in cherry Kool-Aid and saying, "What's fuck mean, Daddy?" The guys from the trout hatchery had their truck parked at the base of the driveway, and they were flinging fish into the pond from plastic sheetrock buckets. The sun struck pink fire off the sides of the rainbow trout as they twisted in the air and hit the surface of the water. The ones that were already in were jumping now, as though they were trying to get back to where they came from, corkscrewing above the surface. Skip parked up the driveway by the steps to the front porch. The baby was asleep in the back of the truck underneath the little canopy of mosquito netting he'd bought. The Taylor brothers, who ran the hatchery, were no danger. They were so brain dead that they wouldn't look twice at a baby. A hoe, a shovel, a chainsaw, a baby in a basket, it was all the same to them. If Skip had had a corpse in the flatbed of the truck, they would scarcely have noticed it, although if he'd had a new truck, they would have been all over it. They spent most of their time sitting by the spillways, shooting muskrats and snapping turtles, before they could get to the fish. Smoking dope, too.
"Yo," Skip said to them.
"Get your rod out, man," said the older one, the one with the beard. "These suckers had hit on baloney if it was on the surface there. They're so nuts."
The other one was closing up the back of the fish truck. He reached into his pocket for the invoice.
"Give this to the boss, why don't you?" he said. "Tell her the herons won't go hungry no more."
"That's for sure," said his brother.
"You find any fish floating with that spear mark in 'em, like a V-shape?"
Skip nodded. He found 4 or 5 a week. Sitting in the chair by the living room window, giving Faith her first bottle of the day, listening to her suck with a gasping sound like she'd never been fed before, he could watch the big gray birds, tall and motionless, at the edge of the water, until suddenly the curved bill plunged into the shallows, and with a movement of the throat not unlike an infant's, it swallowed the fish. Occasionally one missed, and later that day Skip would pull a dull-eyed trout from the rotting leaves in the spillway. There had been trout in Blessing's pond since Ed Blessing had had the hatchery first stock it in the hope that his son would take up fly casting. The boy hadn't. But every summer 100 trout went into the pond, just like every fall the landscape gardener drove out from town and dug up the begonia tubers, wrapped them in cheesecloth, and put them in the basement.
"You stepped in shit with this job,"
said the younger Taylor brother, lighting a Newport and looking out over the pond, where the starlings were wheeling down to meet the fish leaping high, all of them chasing bugs.
"Yeah, I keep hearing that."
"I don't know that I'd want to work for her, though," said the other, looking back at the